We're at line 31 on page 181 there. Because truth is the science of mind, we have to trust truth and have faith in truth and not incline to the side of matter or error by using, for example, hypnotic power. Now, from the bottom of page 181 to the top of 182, where what we begin to see really is that a Christian scientist is one whose mind is truth and not error. Whose mind is love and not hate, fear, and so on. But in this particular context, whose mind is truth and not error. 182, line 7. Laws of nature, as they obtain in physiology, are the opposite of laws of spirit, as they obtain in science. The real nature of everything is, of course, spirit. We cannot obey both physiology and spirit, for the one absolutely destroys the other. 9:10. Science. Line 15. The science of spirit, that is, does not mix with the hypotheses of mortals as found in physiology. And so we return once again to the basic topic of the chapter, which is really mind's government of the body, line 18. This paragraph teems with ideas of government, of power, and of law, spiritual law as against material law, that puts all material conditions under the feet of mind. Now when we come to the end of the chapter, over on page 200, we shall find that all things are put under the feet of man. And this is because man's mind is really mind, capital M, which is conscious, as we see here, of its transcendent and sacred power. Now, all this is the healing law of Christ, or truth, line 32. Which we read makes all things possible to spirit. The one spirit is man's only lawgiver, it says, having power over laws of matter, and this is why it heals. The relationship here between spirit and truth, the law of Christ or truth, the law of spirit. Laws of nature, line 10, which say, for example, that seed must first germinate before a crop can be produced, are erroneous, and they contradict scripture. They are laws of sin, which condemn man to till the ground. Laws of nature, line 19, are really laws of spirit. And therefore, what nature is spirit. When we abide by the law of spirit, the law of our true nature, then without reservation, we give our entire obedience, affection, and strength to divine mind, line 21. And to do so is to obey truth, 23. To obey the law that is of no departure from God, the law which says that man belongs wholly to God. And this, of course, is what gives man power and strength. This actual spiritual law, line 27, whereby truth casts out all evils, is the law which says that man has never been cast out of God and has therefore never become evil. This is the law that gives sight to the blind, hearing to the deaf, etc. Why? Because sight, hearing, speaking, mobility, and so on, have only ever belonged to truth, God. All these faculties, they are of the nature of spiritual understanding in Christian Science. It's the one mind only which is entitled to possess anything, and therefore, indeed, which does possess everything. And with this acknowledgement, we honor the one mind. Now, over to page 184, line 11. Honor only the mind which is truth. Never honor erroneous belief with the title of law, nor yield obedience to erroneous belief. Belief is not entitled to any such honor. Line 12, where we have a further reference to the combination of terms truth, life, and love. Truth, life, and love being man's spiritual lawgivers, they are all that is ever legitimately demanded of man, and all that he is ever forced to honor and obey. In a previous reference to truth, life, and love on page 169, they were presented as the actual activity of divine mind. Here it is demanded that man shows forth this divine activity and thus is controlled, line 16, by divine intelligence. Obeying the laws of truth, life, and love, he does not suffer from seeming to disobey laws of mortal mind. We are being shown a rule of divine science, line 24, which is that the human does not suffer from having broken some so-called physical law because no such law really exists. A rule of divine science. And so, at the bottom of the page, the woman is cured of consumption. Symbolically, in her experience, the wind from the east, which seemed to give her such difficulty, is really the inspiration of the Christ, the wind from the east, the spirit of the Christ, the inspiration of the Christ. And as we have consistently found, the combination of terms truth, life, and love is used to denote the activity of Christ, the Christ mind, the Christ spirit of us all. Freed, therefore, from the belief that she had broken a mortal mind law, the woman breathed the east wind normally. Now, the treatment she was given was entirely metaphysical, 185.3, namely, Christian Science as the only purely mental system of hygiene that there is. The treatment was the opposite of so-called mental medicine or mind cure, such as the necromancers of Egypt used when they strove to match the divine science of immortal mind used by Moses. The one which is hypnotism has its birth in mortal mind, the other which is science in immortal mind. And it's there we see in the text that God is not only capitalized life, line 19, but uncapitalized substance and intelligence as well. Now let's note the terms science, divine science, and Christian science, all in this one paragraph together and used in close association with the infinite as mind. Because back on page 127 in the sixth chapter, it was in the section on science, we remember we were told how these terms, these different uses of the term science, are all synonymous terms for mind. What mind knows about itself is the science of mind, in which man is the image of mind, and in which therefore God and man, divinity and humanity, capitalized and uncapitalized, are forever one. All this, line 24, is ethical and pathological truth power in contrast to drugs and hypnotism and the activity of the material stratum of the human mind called brain. Brain. But a mortal consolidation of material mentality and its suppositional activities. What a definition of brain as the physiological counterfeit of infinite, immortal mind. So the need at the top of 186 is to fill thought with the divine energies of truth. That's what we've been thinking about there, the divine energies of truth, which means to have spirit for our mind instead of the false stimulus and reaction of willpower seeming to fill our mind. The energies of truth found in the understanding of spirit, which is Christian Science, line 6, are forces of unerring mind, as against willful evil human mind or brain forces. And so it is that the nothingness of evil must be established. We've come to line 11 of 186. Evil is nothing. Evil is negation. It is absence. Evil is unreal, without power. Its supposed self-assertiveness is its own self-destruction. If evil is nothing, Then when evil says, I am a real entity overmastering good, line 17, then nothing is saying this, and therefore it is not being said. Nothing that evil is saying anywhere is being said, because nothing is saying it. Life, immortality, good are real. Death, mortality, evil are unreal, a myth. So on line 28 at the bottom, we learn how mortal mind, that is evil, is ignorant of self. And this is like saying that it doesn't know, mortal mind, that its subjective state is in fact matter. Because this is a truth that the textbook has so frequently taught us. The subjective condition of mortal mind, that's what matter is. Mortal mind believes matter to be something besides itself. And accordingly, it enthrones matter as deity and worships it. But divine mind, the one mind, 187.1, on the other hand, is all-knowing. Is ignorant of nothing. It knows that its own subjective state is spirit, and therefore that spirit is not something besides itself, mind. Matter is mindless. And to know that mortal mind is matter, therefore, instead of being ignorant of this, is to establish the nothingness of mortal mind. Mortal mind, which is material sense, or the sense of matter, worships and fears only the thoughts which it forms. 187.8. So to the action of mortal mind in the marginal heading there, where we come really to the heart of the physiological myth. Because all action of the mortal body is voluntary action. That is, it proceeds from the consent of the will. The action of the valves of the heart is no more involuntary than the action of raising the hand. There is no involuntary action, line 22. Mortal mind is the cause of all materialistic action. It's admitted that raising the hand has a voluntary mental cause, yet matter is supposed to cause the opening and closing of the valves of the heart involuntarily. Believing this costs fallen physiological man his paradise, his conscious, voluntary control over his body. He tries, line 24, to classify action as voluntary and involuntary, and suffers from the attempt. Now, on the other hand, as we conceive the truth of the situation, divine mind includes all action and volition, and man in science is governed by this mind. And we could note here the precise use of the terms mortal mind, human mind, divine mind. The human mind must awaken to the fact in science that mind is not mortal, but is immortal. Because as it does this, then of course it, the human mind, yields to the divine mind. And the divine mind is always in conscious, voluntary control of its own body, which is man. So, as the dead body proves at the bottom of the page there, the human mind, believing that it is mortal, is responsible for all the so-called life and action of the material body. But in fact, there is no death. And therefore, after what seems to be death, this mind still holds in belief a body through which it acts and which appears to the human mind to live. Mortal mind is put off only, of course, as mind is found to be immortal and man to be the image or body of this mind. Now we are called upon to consider the embryonic stage of the build-up of mortal mind. And we have the marginal heading there on page 188, line 5, embryonic sinful thoughts, sinful beliefs. Original sin is defined here as an unconscious error in the beginning, an embryonic thought without motive that afterwards grows terrible in strength and influence. But an unconscious error, a motiveless thought, is surely nothing from the very beginning. It has no origin. It is of the nature of a dream. And just as much a dream when mortal man says he is conscious as when he says he is unconscious. This dream, made up of ignorance, sin, fear, disease, and so on, must be uprooted and cast out. Line 27. And the last paragraph on 188, just because the sun disappears at night, no one fears that it will not reappear the next day. Astronomical science destroys the fear that the sun is not there just because it isn't seen. So it is with unseen Christian science, 189, and its ever-present power to establish harmony. 189.18, the human mortal mind is a perversion of immortal divine mind. The former makes all things start from the lowest mortal thought, whereas the formations of the latter proceed from their divine source. And tracing them as they come from their divine source, our own being as these formations constantly ascends to the source from which it comes. This, of course, is something which Jesus in the Gospels constantly teaches us. Now, what we are considering here is the subject of human reproduction, 189.27. which is one with which physiology is so basically concerned. The mortal species is reproduced because mortals partake of the tree of knowledge and believe they are gods. Their evolution is always in the direct line of matter, the subjective condition of mortal mind. There we have it again, matter, the subjective condition of mortal mind, line 32. According to mortal belief, over the page, an inanimate, unconscious seedling produces mortals both body and mind. But how can this be so, if matter is ignorant of itself, and therefore ignorant of what it is supposed to produce? Back on 186, it was mortal mind that was said to be ignorant of self, and here on 190, line 8, matter is ignorant of itself. In fact, the entire proposition of the physiological tree of knowledge is a state of ignorance, of not knowing, of false knowledge, which must yield in science to the true self-knowledge of mind. And thus, on 190, it's all about the birth, growth, maturity, and decay of mortals. The temporal seeming that finally disappears in favor of immortal man, who is the real man. At the bottom of the page, the Hebrew bard contrasts these two opposing views of man, just as he might have done with the two trees in the midst of the Garden of Eden, if he were discussing them. Now to the top of 191, where we see that brain once more is the material opposite of one infinite mind. This one infinite mind, whose organ is not matter brain, but is man, in the likeness of this mind. Well, having learnt the nothingness of mortal embryology and the birth, growth, maturity, and decay stages of mortal man, we are led at last to the true idea of origin and birth. That is, to where, on line 11, where the young child was. The idea of immortal birth in the marginal heading, the birth of man's true immortality. In the text, even to the birth of a new old idea, to the spiritual sense of being and of what life, tree of life, not the tree of death, includes. Well, this life is truth, line 14. In its unity and wholeness. Its pinions of light, that is to say, its true knowledge, transforming the whole earth, chasing away the darkness of error, the darkness of ignorance, the darkness of false knowledge, the lie that man ever departed from God, truth. And this means that the divine principle of man is dawning on human thought. The principle which is one mind, and therefore is life. It's his mind, capital M, which determines man's prospects for life, 19. and indeed the prospects of everything else. It's because of mind, not because of any volition of its own, that the blade of grass springs up, the spray buds, the leaf unfolds, etc., etc. This is the science of everything's true being, line 24, in which man and immortality are based on spirit, not matter. Mind sending forth the aroma of its own subjective condition, spirit, which is the atmosphere of intelligence. This is the true idea of which the pulpy substance under the skull is a mockery of intelligence, a mimicry of mind. So now we can define what a Christian Scientist is. 192.4. To be a Christian Scientist is to quit reliance on the false and grasp the true. To leave all for Christ. For that which comes from principle. Separating ourselves from opinions which come from corporeality. Quit, leave, separate on the one hand, grasp and be on the other. And this is because spirit itself is never separate from, never quits God. Spirit is God. So Christian Scientists find their being in and of Christ, in and of Spirit, the divine principle from which they come is Spirit. So it follows that the Christian Scientist does not identify himself with erring power, the blind force of willpower, but with the opposite of this, namely the wisdom of immortal mind. The good he does, the good he embodies, gives him the only power obtainable, line 23. Evil, which is not power, ere long betrays its weakness and falls, never to rise. We, as Christian Scientists, rise through understanding that man never fell away from God. Now we're anticipating the coming eighth chapter, Footsteps of Truth, at the bottom of line of page 192. Because we are learning to walk in the footsteps of truth and love. We're learning to follow Christ in Christianity, line 29, by understanding divine metaphysics. To lay down all for Christ, to follow Christ in Christianity, is to understand and therefore to be the divine metaphysics of truth and love. To follow something is to understand it, one step at a time. And this involves unself-love, leaving all for Christ, leaving the mortal sense of self for Christ as self, which receives directly the divine power as against receiving erring power, the power of the human will. Now the healing of Mr. Clark in Lynn on line 32 proves that human thought receives divine power directly when it holds itself in line with unself-love. Mr. Clark was believed to have fallen on a wooden spike when he was a boy, and now to be dying. But we have learnt that it is evil, not man, which is weak, and which falls never to rise. And therefore Mr. Clark rose up a new man, reborn. What really sat at his bedside and healed him was not a person as such, but his own unselfed Christ selfhood in Christianity, the divine metaphysics of truth and love. No part of truth ever fell or departed from truth, because truth is love. Love holds the wholeness of truth whereof man is constituted in a state of unfragmentable wholeness. And so, in the case of Mr. Clark of Lynn, it was proved, 193.32, that life is God. Life, the forever undividedness of truth and love, is spirit, which is not separate from God because it is God. And so the spiritual idea of man, over the page to 194.4, was discerned to coincide with the divine mind. Mind is spirit, not matter, just as truth is love, not fragmentation or fallen man. This is life. Life not subject to death. A false belief having been corrected, truth sent a report of health over Mr. Clark's body, and he rose up healed. Well, the text continues to put physiology in its place. Man is immortal in spiritual understanding, line 15, and mortal only in material belief. Mortal man can be deaf and blind, if mortal mind says he is, without his auditory nerve or his optic nerve ever having been injured. Man's immortal mind, capital M, is what really sees and hears, wholly irrespective of matter or material nerves. And so mortal mind, with all its physiological theories, is simply a thing of education, of belief. As it says in the marginal heading there, the power of habit. It's constituted solely of a build-up of false knowledge. For example, the senses of Caspar Hauser in these two paragraphs were no different from the senses of any other mortal. It's just that in his case they were educated in one direction. Normal light and food convulsed him with anguish, while with us these same senses are trained in an opposite direction. So, 195.12, is it mortal mind or immortal mind that is causative? The divine principle of metaphysical science states that mind, not matter, is causative. And this principle of all science is what solves the problem of an apparently material world. How? By translating it back into mind. To this end, instead of the tangled barbarisms of learning, line 23, academics of the right sort are requisite. Line 19. And what are these academics of the right sort? Well, for instance, line 17, astronomy, natural history, chemistry, music, mathematics. Why? Because all these subjects furnish the semblance of an idea governed by its principle. Mind being the cause of all effect. Effect as idea is governed by this principle, which is mind. And the symbol of the idea, which thus resembles the idea, as represented by these different human subjects, is translated from apparent materiality into the idea itself. Therefore, thought, line 16, fed with this idea, and as this idea passes naturally from effect back to mind, its cause. And in this way, the whole redemptive cyclic purpose of spiritual and scientific translation regarding our present universe is accomplished. Now, the top of 196 re-emphasizes the dangers of materialistic knowledge as being basic to the chapter as a whole. Mortal mind knowledge cannot save mortal man from the dire effects of this very knowledge. In the second paragraph of 196, we're back to the basic theme that such knowledge is sin, and that as such it brings death. In the third paragraph, the hymn which is able to destroy soul and body in hell is this sin of physiological knowledge. And we find sin's opposite in this context in life or truth, line 16. Truth, the divine self-knowledge, is life because it's whole and because it's indivisible, and it's therefore unaccompanied by sickness, sin, and death. Now the rest of page 196, let images and thoughts of disease be effaced, ruled out of mortal mind, on mortal mind, instead of being impressed there, so that the fear of disease and the image of it brought before the mind is not afterwards outlined on the body. The press, line 31, or what today we would call the media, has much to answer for in propagating all this false knowledge. 197:8, God said of the tree of knowledge, which bears the fruit of sin, disease, and death, in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. To cultivate the knowledge now broadcast in the earth is to cultivate fear. So let us not cultivate the tree of mortal knowledge in our garden, but rather cultivate the tree of life. hardier and more honest than our trained physiologists and sleek politicians were our more ignorant forefathers. More ignorant regarding physiological knowledge. Now, line 30 and over the page, the doctor's mental fear and power, and the power of his thought, should not be allowed to mold and form the belief of his patient regarding disease, for the stronger thought rules the weaker. In 198, the whole of that page is bearing out that teaching. Now, almost the last topic of the chapter we come to is the physiology of the muscular system of the mortal body, starting 198, 929. Not material exercise, but belief in the power of the exercise develops the muscles of the blacksmith's arm. If this were not so, the hammer too would increase in size, for both the hammer and the arm are equally material. But in the case of the hammer, there is no mortal belief that this is what will happen. 199.8, muscles are not self-acting. Mind, little m, moves them, otherwise they are motionless. The positive fact is that mind, capital M, alone enlarges and empowers man. God and man, mind and body, are one, and this one is mind. So mind both demands power and supplies power. In other words, the mind's body demands of its mind the supply of the power which it requires for its movements. And its mind supplies this power. Now, on line 19, the feats of the gymnast prove that latent mental fears are subdued by him, or else he couldn't possibly do what he does. Blondin, line 25, crossing Niagara on a tightrope, illustrated this. Not lubricating oil, but the belief that he could do what he set out to do gave his muscles, that is to say, his thought forces. What muscles are, his thought forces, their flexibility and power. So the topic turns to the muscular, athletic gods of ancient Greece. If you eat the physiological apple, you will be powerful, muscular gods, the serpent said in effect to Adam and Eve. So from the bottom of 199 to the top of page 200. The text contrasts this plurality of the gods of Mount Olympus, which Homer sang about, and which thereby became alive in the belief of the Greek nation, with the one true God of Mount Sinai, revealed by Moses, which David sang about, and which was truly the very life of the nation of Israel. The issue is between pagan worship with its muscularity and the worship of God in spirit. Line 5. With the latter, the grand human capacities of being bestowed by immortal mind take the place of muscular capacity bestowed by mortal mind. The one God is the mind which is spirit, in contrast to organic physiological gods. Now, four final paragraphs on page 200 bring the chapter to a close. The term on line 8 is soul, and on lines 9 and 11, life. The explanation of body, other than by soul, will always be erroneous, namely, that body is mortal and physiological. Soul alone truly explains what body is, because it's in the term soul that we understand identity or body. But soul is life, and life is soul. This is the science of man's true being. Line 16. In this context, soul's body corresponds to life's man. Just as life, line 9, is, always has been, and ever will be, independent of matter, so man formed spiritually was, is, and ever will be perfect like God, his life. Because all things are put under his feet. At the end of this chapter, line 15, man obviously can take the footsteps of truth unfolded in the next chapter. So, in the final paragraph of all, the tree of physiological knowledge called in the New Testament the accursed tree, or the tree of death, because on it Jesus is supposed to have been crucified. This is replaced in human experience by the tree of life. Jesus Christ and him crucified is replaced by Jesus Christ and him glorified. The only death, the only crucifixion, is the death of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, not of man. Man is identified with the tree of life, as Jesus proved at the resurrection. There never really were two kinds of tree in the garden. There is only ever the tree of life, from which man is never expelled, and whereby he lives and does not die. Body glorified, absolved from sin and death, is man's resurrection body, as Paul terms it. This is the human body as the living symbol of the divine in process of total translation. Jesus didn't really have to regain paradise. He proved at the resurrection that paradise had never been lost in a process of organic birth. His God mind had never lost control over its own body man. He thus reflected God's dominion over the works of God's own hands, as the psalm quotes there. And so, as we merge across to page 201 and into the chapter Footsteps of Truth, the eighth chapter of the textbook, The Old Things of Physiological Knowledge and Belief Pass Away, and all things, not some things, become new.
No more recording on this tape.